The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning. In the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha said, "At all times, for all beings, I teach the Dharma equally, never growing weary or disheartened. To those in low positions and high positions, to those of great wealth, to those in poverty, to those who have many blessings in their life, to those who live within great adversity, to those who follow the precepts and live good lives, to those who don't. I cause the Dharma to rain on all of them equally." So this is the essence of the heart of the Bodhisattva, to want to and endeavor to be committed to bringing all that is good into this world, to trying to alleviate all the harm. And in order to do that, we have to study the mind. So I wanted to talk this morning a little bit about the great vows, the Bodhisattva vows. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. The dharmas are boundless, I vow to master them. And the Buddha way is unattainable, and I vow to attain it. These great vows are one of the first things that a student encounters when they come to the monastery, to the temple. And in that, you are not, the person who's just entering is not making those vows. They're being introduced to them, they're meeting them, hearing them perhaps for the first time. Perhaps they begin to reflect on them. And perhaps at some point they take those vows as their own. And each of these vows, they are great vows, after all, points to both samsara and nirvana, to delusion and enlightenment, to suffering and the liberation of suffering. They are great because they encompass the whole of reality, the whole of the world, the whole of us, as one undivided, complete, all-encompassing body and mind, Dharma Dhatu, one reality. And they are that because we are that. We are that vast. We can hold all of that. We do all the time, whether we know it or not. But we can learn, discover our capacity to hold all of that without conflict. And so like the Four Noble Truths, these vows ask us to turn towards, face this very place where we are, right where we find ourselves. The Buddha said all conditioned existence is dukkha, the samskaras, all, everything. Everything and all of everything is conditioned existence, meaning that it arises not independently, not by itself, not on its own, but rather through this intricate web of karmic actions and conditions, internally and externally. And when that which arises, arises from a false sense of self, from desires and grasping, from false views, conflicts, suffering, greed, anger, delusion, are bound to follow. And yet, at every step along the way, there is something that is peaceful by its very nature. In every thought, in every word, in every action, within every subject, within every object, every perception, every intention. These vows are inviting us to see things in this way. It's thought that they originated in China around the 6th century, so they've been around for a while. There are, if you look, go look in, you'll find many different translations of these great vows, which are really Mahayana vows, vows of the Mahayana, of the Bodhisattva path. And this first vow, the sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them, literally translated means the many beings, no limit, pledge, vow, carry across. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them, to liberate them, to awaken with them, to enlighten them, other translations. And save is, within a Western context, a little tricky, right? Because there's that sense, that potential sense of a missionary vow. It is not that. One translation is to liberate all the ordinary beings from my mind. Save means to enlighten, to enable every being to cross over to the shore of enlightenment, to that shore of peacefulness. Huainong said, it's not that I will save you, but that sentient beings, each with their own natures, can save themselves, can liberate themselves. What does this mean? Despite craving and delusions, you, each of us, have within ourselves the attributes of enlightenment. And so, with correct views, seeing things clearly, practicing them based in those correct views, if false views arise, then with correct views, we can liberate those false views. If delusion appears, then with wisdom we can enlighten that delusion. If evil comes, if harmful actions come forward, then with good we can correct that. If craving comes, with this enlightened, these enlightened qualities, we can free ourselves of that craving. And so in a way, it's the wonderful and challenging truth of Dharma that no one is coming to save you, and you do not need to be saved. Not in the way that we think. Your own nature is already complete in full, Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha. That's what we've been studying this ongo, but we're always, always, always studying this. Huainong said, it's just that this nature of original enlightenment, that's what saves you. It's because we have Buddha nature that we can't even speak of this. And we could interpret that wrongly, that each of us must do this for ourselves. Only we ourselves can do this. We can misunderstand this to mean that since only you can liberate yourself, I have no part of it. You're over there saving your ass. I'm over here saving my ass, right? We might get together and talk about it or have a party about it or moan about it, but we're each in our respective corners doing what only we can do. That's not a correct view. Not only because it's not the Bodhisattva vow, but the Bodhisattva vow is just representing what is real, what is true, what we discover, what every human being who awakens Buddha mind discovers to be true. We're not trying to live our lives in accord with teachings that somebody has put up on a map and said, this is what you should do. We're trying to live our lives in accord to what is actually true. The teachings are just expressions of that. It's in the very knowing that each person themselves can awaken, can free themselves. That is the basis of Kanon Bodhisattva's wisdom. That's what allows her to be compassionate and tireless, and courageous. If we just think in terms of saving oneself, saving myself, that's too cut off. If I just think in terms of saving others, that I am going to fix you, I'm going to take away your delusion, that's an unrealistic expectation. Khandra Rinpoche said, there's a belief that many of us unconsciously fall into. Many who try to practice compassion and loving kindness take upon themselves the tremendous pressure of thinking everyone else's happiness depends on you. The Bodhisattva has a much larger perspective. They know that beings can truly find their happiness ultimately from within themselves. Knowing that, really understanding that, then and now, what can I do? What can I do to help? And so this vow to alleviate suffering means to do whatever we can to open up such a path for each person, every creature, to abide within their own Dharma state, to examine their own mind, to work within their own Buddha field, their own causes and conditions, to liberate themselves. It's like you see somebody going down a path, and there are all of these obstructions, trees, entanglements, boulders, mudslides, and they have to go down the path, but it's such a hard journey, and so you help out a little bit. You clear the path, try and open it up. Or you're in a room where there's no light, and so you just draw back the curtain just a little bit and let a little light come through. In a sense, that's what the teachings are doing. That's what teachers do, is they just keep pointing to the fact that there's a little light here, right? There are some obstructions here, but there are ways to clear those obstructions. In the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, there's one of the similes. The Buddha says it's like pure honey that is in a cave or in a tree, and it's surrounded and protected by a swarm of bees. But someone may come along who knows how to encourage those bees to move away so that they can take some of that honey and then do with it what they will. They can eat it, they can give it away. And so the Bodhisattva is not collecting that honey for the person, but they can point to the place where the honey is. They can maybe offer some skills, some skillfulness around bees, so that they don't injure the bees, they don't get stung. So that then the person themselves can go and collect that honey. I vow to save them. That vow is based in the understanding that there's a great deal we can do for each other. Just as we are showing ourselves, there's a great deal we can do for ourselves, more than we imagine. So we should never give up on ourselves. We should never give up on anyone else's potential, even when people in situations seem so intractable, or people can seem so wedded to their suffering or to their habitual ways or to their delusions. That may be true. But everything is in a state of change. Everything is moving. And so there are conditions which are significant in bringing that state of being to be. In a sense, the Bodhisattva is working to shift some of those, have an effect on those conditions. I mean, that's what this is about, right? It's helping to create conditions in which it is easier to do something which is difficult to do. I vow to save them. Sentient beings are numberless means we can only go a certain distance. You know, it's like we have a guide. We're asking for directions. And they say, well, let me go with you. I'll show you the way. And they travel with us, and we think, this is great. Thank you so much. And then they get to a certain place and they say, now I have to leave you. Now you have to go. And you say, no, 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 won't you come along? Won't you go with me the whole way? And the teacher says, no, I can't do that. You don't need me to do that. This is where you have to go. And then we take a step and we realize, oh, they were right. We can teach someone to swim, but we can't swim for them. When the student enters the water, they realize, oh, not only can I swim, I'm swimming. It's like how many times somebody has come into Doksan, often during Sesshin, and say, I can't do this. I say, but you are. This is what doing it looks like. We each carry ourselves, and we get lots of support, and we must have that. It's very important. None of us, no one does this alone, not in that way. And so think of the parables we've been studying, the burning house parable. The parent realized, I could carry these children out, because they don't realize they're in a burning house. They're in peril. They could, but they don't. They have to find a skillful way that the children themselves can leave. The Dharma rain parable, the rain falls equally. All plants moistened by the same rain. Each has its own differences, the sutra says. But each plant has to actually drink. Right? The water may be all around, but that isn't enough. We can be dying of thirst sitting by the river, but we actually have to lean over and take a sip. The Phantom City parable, the illusory city, provides some respite in a moment of discouragement, of loss of trust and faith in ourselves, so we can actually stop for a minute and realize how far we've come. Rebuild our spirit, build our confidence. But the guide, even when the guide says, okay, you can't stay here, I just created this illusory city, but we still have to be the ones that get up and walk, right? The guide doesn't carry us. And that's such an important element of the Buddha Dharma. Such a deep understanding. Such an important element of compassion. So that then in the second vow, desires are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. The literal meaning is grief, distress, no exhausting, pledge, vow, conclude. Desires are inexhaustible. This grief, this distress has no end. I vow, I pledge to put an end to them. And this grief, distress are the kleshas. So when we talk about desire, that can be a little confusing. Right? Because we also rely on desires to practice. So these kleshas are the states of mind, of our thoughts, of our body, the three poisons, the many states that we find ourselves in, greed, anger, delusion, jealousy, and pride, that lead us to work against ourselves and work against others. And so to put an end to them means to conclude, to dismiss, to cut off, to abandon. Huainong says, with your own mind, cast aside everything that is unreal, everything that is false. So to free ourselves of the delusions in our mind, in the minds of others, which are the breeding ground of those kleshas, of those desires. But if we just think of energy, of desire, right, as something that appears within us, right? So we're just sitting there minding our own business and suddenly there's a desire, right? And we feel it, right? It has an energy, it has a quality to it. We can recognize this desire is different from this one. This is moving in this direction. This one moves in a different direction. This one is seated in a particular part of our body, for instance. This one in a different part of our body. But if we think of them as desires, as energy, then those desires, that energy, that sort of force, that field of energy, can reinforce, comes from, right, a field that is already established, already developed. And in a sense, part of it is our humanity, our biology, right? I mean, these desires don't come from nowhere. They come from our being, our psychological, our emotional, our mental, our physical, our genetic being. But delusion reinforces, misunderstands, misinterprets those desires, comes to all kinds of notions and conclusions about them that are not often true. And then we respond, and we set up patterns of responding so that those desires create negative patterns. They divide, they separate, they intoxicate, they confuse us, they lead to regret. But if we think of the desire as just energy that appears, it's the mind that gives it direction. It's our thoughts that give them meaning, give them conviction and strength. And that's such an essential part of what's happening in Zazen. So in the instruction to acknowledge what is arising, that word is so powerful, is so pregnant, was significant in terms of what are we actually trying to do in that moment of acknowledgement. To not suppress, to not deny, to not avoid, to not get mired in, to not give meaning to not establish it as something in distinction to something else, to not compare it, to not judge it, all of these different machinations of the mind, to actually interrupt all of those patterns and to just experience it as it is. And then we can begin to experience it as just a force, an energy that in and of itself is not good or bad. In of itself is not a thing. And now it becomes much, much more workable because it has been, in a sense, freed, divested of all that investment, that person, this self. And so we study the Dharma, we study the precepts, we practice the paramitas, we live a bodhisattva life. We bring that into our intentions. We raise bodhicitta. We establish right intention. All of this is about, in a sense, working within these fields of energy that manifest in all of these various ways. And we're, in a sense, learning how to hold those in ways that are actually in accord, not just with the Dharma, but with ourselves. And so that's why vow is so important. Then when we establish a vow, when we establish an intention, we're sort of talking about, in a way, how we want to align this field that we are living in, that every single person is living in a way that is now conscious, right? And think about it. If we don't do that, there are lots of other people and forces and companies and corporations and governments that will do that for you, that will tell you what to think, that will tell you what to feel, will tell you what this means. Further, will tell you who you are, and at the same time tell you who you're not. Will set you up in a comparison with everything else and basically tell you where you stand in relationship to all of that. What you are capable of, what you're not. Like there's just a whole world, we call it samsara, that's just waiting. And actually not waiting, they're busy at it. All the time. And as practitioners, if we examine, if we reflect, if we sort of educate ourselves about that, we might think that we're above it. I would suggest you pause, look again. Those forces, those fields of energy, if you will, are very, very powerful, very sophisticated. Why, after all, do we follow desires over and over again that we know are going to cause disappointment and regret? The Buddha said it's because essentially we still believe in them. We still think on some level they work, they're true. It's like in those moments, do we doubt that there is a deeper, a truer contentment, joy, satisfaction? And that's why our meditation practice is so important, so essential. Because it is really the training ground for how to reclaim your natural mind. To begin to discern through all the weeds what is actually important in this life. And so when we study those many desires that arise within us, we begin to study, this is right effort, which ones to let go of, which ones are not helpful, not skillful, and which ones are. Which ones do we strengthen? We begin to see how all of the many ways in which we abdicate our responsibility, abdicate, try and give away our power. We learn how to recognize how and under what conditions we actually act not so well. We say things, we do things that are hurtful to other people, sometimes willfully and consciously, sometimes, oftentimes not. So the workshop that we had this week for the White Identified Sangha, primarily on microaggressions, is part of it. How to recognize thoughts and responses and behaviors that we have been conditioned to have, it shouldn't surprise us, that are hurting people and are actually hurting us as white people in this case, speaking as a white person. When I say us, I am referring to the us of white people, not the us of everyone. Because if we don't recognize those things, then how can we fulfill that vow? And in that, we're discovering how to free ourselves and how to free others. Desires are inexhaustible. They're not outside of us. They don't have their own power, even though they sometimes seem to. And in a sense, if we think, you know, I never have a desire that I haven't given permission to have, right? This is not happening against my will. And we have choice, right? That's what puts us in the human realm from a Buddhist perspective. We have choice. Because they're empty of their own existence, they can't be extinguished. So when we chant to put an end to them, we're not talking about extinguishing anything. They're not born, they don't die. They do appear, but how do they appear? What is it that's appearing? And so this vow is also saying to not fight the beings in your mind, desires, those karmic patterns. Do not fight against yourself. Do not fight the way. At the same time that we're practicing not being attached to them or indifferent, Dogen says, don't hate what is close, don't love what is close, don't hate what is far away, don't love what is far away. Just let your mind be bright and clear. Right? Because if we hold it too tightly, it's like trying to take a wild thing, right, that has all this energy and put it in a very small confinement, very small container. What happens? It gets wilder. Some boundaries are necessary, right? That's the holding of that desire within mindfulness. That's the boundary, but it's not too tight. I vow to put an end to them. They are not what we think they are. And so to let go of our thoughts about desires and realize them as they are. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. The vow literally states, dharma gates, no measure, vow, learn. Learning, of course, is a little tricky, right? Because we have a lot of meaning around the word learning. We learn about knowledge. We learn things in school. This is a different kind of learning, a different kind of study. Dogen says, when the Dharma does not fill our body and mind, then we think that we have enough. You know, lack of humility, arrogance, just being stubborn-headed, thick-headed, always comes from not actually understanding that we are separate, we're distant. Right? That's why the importance of Buddha Dharma as being a path of inquiry. You know, coming into face-to-face teaching is always bringing to the surface that sense of question, of inquiry, of examination. What is it? You know, very often students are like, what am I supposed to say? What should I be asking? There's not a should. It's really being in this burning house, being such a person, a Buddha nature, wanting to not waste this life, Now, what do you want to know? What do you need to know? Where does that examination need to take place? But when the Dharma does fill our body and mind, Dogen says, then we realize something is missing. The Dharmas are boundless. You know, in the beginning of practice, I would also often think, oh, really, God, right? You know, it just seemed exhausting because I just felt so mired in my own confusion and lack of understanding. It just seemed arduous. As though if it someday ended, then it's like, okay, I can like suffer through this because one day, you know, it's going to be over. Silly. Right? To really cultivate a love for study. Right? And I understood it even then. It's like hard to suffer suffering when it's real, when it's strong, when we're caught in it. It's hard to like, okay, this is joyful. No, it's actually not. It's hard. It was hard to find the joy in it. But it had everything to do with all that I was bringing to it, the meaning that I was ascribing to it, my sense of self that I was laying all over it, right? My identity. I'm not allowed any joy, right? Until some sense of something happening, and then I'll have a little. If I allow that joy, that means I'm not really practicing. All kinds of notions, all kinds of rules we can lay down on ourselves and believe them to be true, and then practice accordingly as though they are true. But they're not. When the Dharma fills our body and mind, we realize something is missing. It's wonderful. Dogen says there are many aspects of worldly life, spiritual life, that we only recognize and understand as a result of the power of our penetrating vision to show us. We can only go as far as we can go right now with this mind, this awareness, this understanding, this capacity. But whatever that limit is just the temporary. It's just the temporary. And that practice is constantly opening that up, constantly extending that, constantly increasing that sense of our capacity or of what the world is. And so he says, in order to appreciate the 10,000 dharmas, we should know that although they may look round or square, the other qualities of oceans and mountains and worlds and self are infinite in variety. It is so not only about ourselves, but also directly here, even in a drop of water. The dharmas are boundless, I vow to master them, to raise Bodhi mind, to practice, to gain confidence in that, to realize, to gain understanding, and then to raise Bodhi mind, and then to practice, and to extend ourselves, and to gain confidence, and then to raise Bodhi mind. It's an ongoing, beautiful, self-fulfilling path. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this traceless enlightenment continues endlessly. So to think of your Dharma practice, your Zazen, as being a boundless field. And so we take refuge in the Dharma again, over and over again. We practice, we move out into the world, we have experiences. We get disrupted, things happen, they press in upon us. We act badly, we forget, we misstep. We become inspired again, we recommit. All of this is part of the web. To delight in the never-ending path of study, to let what is not clear, what is not embodied, bring us in. Like just experience all those things as messages, calling us back. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. The translation is Buddha way, no top, pledge, vow, become. To become the Buddha way, to embody it. We spoke this week in the Mando and the Faith Mind and the Lotus Sutra of that sense of the Lotus Sutra as your mind, as the whole body and mind, right? That ultimately it's not in a text, a sacred text. As important as that is, it's not there. No top, there is nothing higher, outside, apart, before, after. It doesn't mean that it's superior to other things. It means that there is nothing else. That's why the Buddha way is present from a Buddhist perspective in every religion. It's the real truth. If there is real truth in any tradition, in any teaching, in any field, in any understanding, it's the Buddha way. Because in that way, it's not about Buddhism. The Buddha way is beyond Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's not defined by Buddhism. It's not ultimately a religion or spirituality. We use all of those, we language it in those ways because it's helpful. It's a way of talking. It's a way of examining. It's a way of gaining understanding. But we should understand, as the Buddha said, those are just convenient designations to practice and live these vows. A vow is to commit to a way, to commit to something that is that important, right? And that's why we shouldn't make those vows right away. We're not ready. We need to actually examine this field that we are in, that we are contemplating, that we are practicing, before we make that commitment. Because in making that commitment, we are, in the best way, binding ourselves. We are pledging ourselves to that. And we should know what we're doing to the best of our ability. We'll always be doing that. We'll always be making a vow within some lack of understanding. That's just the way it works. That's the faith. That's the madness of leaping. But I'm not entirely certain. That's right. Are you certain enough? I'm not entirely clear. That's right. Yes. Very ordinary. But are you clear enough? Clear enough for who? For you. And that means to actually encounter intimately and realize that which we seek, we have to let go of that very thing. Ideas and expectations, goals, sense of completion, and trust this mind. Trust the Dharma of this mind. And along the way, just notice, take notice of how when we attach to something, it creates more misery. See how without a sense of vow, of purpose, of some underlying sense of what this life is, can be, ought to be, then what is the unifying force? What is the commitment? What is the basis upon which we are making all of those many decisions, all of those many choices? Within our mindfulness, there can be a blindness if we don't have a sense of the path, right? And how without commitment to that path, we can fluctuate. It's so easy to get tossed around, right? It's the commitment that holds us to that very thing, so that within those fluctuations, right, when things get turbulent, when we waver, when we doubt, we're doubting, we're wavering from within that commitment. That is an incredibly powerful thing. And it's awake. It's not a blind commitment. It's not a blind faith. It's examining. I think of the student who asked Master Zhaozhou, what is meditation? Zhaozhou said, it is not meditation. And the student says, well, then what is it? He said, it's alive. Don't ever let it become something else. Huainong said, with regards to these vows, he said, always practice with humility. Respect every being. Avoid attachments. And give rise to the wisdom of your own mind to liberate all delusions. It is through liberating your mind that Buddhahood is attained. This is the power of these great vows. You know, there is nothing that is not alive. Yet then how is it that so much within us or outside of us can seem at times inert, dull, dead? Wendell Berry said, there is nothing that is not sacred. There is only that which we have desecrated. That's how powerful we are. But that very same mind, because there is only this one bright Buddha mind, is the mind that makes intimate contact, that touches that sacredness. And you know it. You can't keep it. But you know something has been encountered, something alive is here now, calling you in. So I'll end with a poem. Without concern for how large, how long, how trying, without anxiety for how capable, how skillful, how virtuous, I send all the heroes and the slackers home. I only know this. This dawn, never before, has arrived. An invitation to one day, with one intention, with one generosity, this is sufficient. This is never arising. This is my offering.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.